Welcome to PostStatus Draft, the official podcast for PostStatus, a website with news and information for WordPress professionals. Today I talk with WordPress extraordinaire Carrie Dills. Carrie is making her living strictly through her blog, podcast, and courses, and we talk about making a living as a self-employed entrepreneur without doing services. If you enjoy this podcast, you can get a lot more quality news and analysis from the PostStatus Club multiple times per week. Check out our current club members, site partners, and join the club on our website at poststatus.com/club. You'll be joining more than 850 wonderful club members, and you'll never miss important WordPress news again. Today, I'd like to feature one of our partners, Prospress. Prospress makes the WooCommerce subscriptions plugin that enables you to turn your online business into a recurring revenue business. Whether you want to ship a box or set up digital subscriptions like I have on PostStatus, Prospress has you covered. Check out prospress.com, that's P-R-O-S-P-R-E-S-S.com for more, and thanks to Prospress for being a PostStatus partner. Now here's our show. Hello and welcome to the PostStatus Draft Podcast. I have a special guest today, Carrie Dills. Carrie is a good friend and she runs Office Hours FM, and you can also find her blog at carriedills.com. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, Brian.
Today we're going to talk about making money.
Making it rain.
That's right. So multiple times I've tried to get you on the podcast in an unprofessional manner of asking you at the last minute if you'd like to be on. I did so again, and this time it worked. So I'm very happy to have you.
Awesome. Glad to be on.
Yeah. So for anyone that doesn't know what you do, why don't you give us the 10,000 foot, 30 second view, and then we'll kind of dig into your story and how you're putting bread on the table.
Sure thing. So I've been doing development in some form or fashion as a freelancer for many, many moons. And I guess as of last fall, I decided to back out of client work and pursue some different forms of revenue and basically just take a break for something that I've been doing a long time.
Mm-hmm. So now that's turned itself into three or four different avenues for money making. So could you kind of lay those out there and kind of rank them in terms of where your hours go, even if that doesn't necessarily translate to how the income comes back?
Sure. If you count my Uber driving, then there's five streams.
Yeah, I was telling Carrie right before we got on the podcast, I was reading her post about her short-lived career as an Uber driver, which I found fascinating. You did three rides. I wonder what average is for an Uber driver.
You know, I don't know, but I will tell you this, and I know it's completely off topic, but so we just are in the process of switching our insurance to a carrier that has or that covers rideshare. Uh-huh. So I may be back in business soon, and then I can tell you what an average is.
Cool. Well, we can chat a little bit more about it, because I actually have a thing or two, an idea or two about ridesharing. But anyway, so what, putting your potentially lucrative future Uber career aside, where do you spend your time?
Yes. I spend the majority of my time on my podcast, Office Hours FM, as you mentioned. And behind that is probably writing courses. And behind that is writing on my blog, which kind of indirectly helps produce affiliate income. And then after that, at the very least of the totem pole is my theme that I've got out there. I don't want to say it's neglected. It's actually in the process of getting ready to release a new version of it, but it has not been a priority for a while.
Yeah. So you are pumping out podcasts at a steady rate once a week, and it looks like you are really good at being at standard intervals. Is that right? You're at episode 137 is your most recent that I see.
Yep. And I don't think I've missed a week since I started, other than when it was like planned breaks over the holiday or something. But
so well done on you for that.
Thanks.
It's very, very impressive. And you came from a world of client work and freelancing and more, I guess, traditional self-employment avenues. And a lot of people might look at what you're doing now as freeing, you know, because you're really only doing things on your own time and what you decide to spend your energy on versus, you know, having a client project that has a deadline and all that kind of stuff. In what ways is that an incorrect assumption that your time is now freer?
For someone who doesn't have a job, I work a whole lot.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that actually pans out, but it's freeing, but not really more so, I would say, than when I was doing client work, because I could still, I mean, freedom in terms of setting schedule. Mm-hmm. The freedom, I guess, is what you said, the ability to choose what I focus on and when I focus on those things. So the part that's maybe, oh, I don't know. It's maybe people are, if they're in a moment where they've had a bad project or something, they're like, oh my gosh, I don't want to do client work. Well, here's a fact. I took a significant income hit. Mm-hmm. Now it was a planned income hit, but, you know, dropping client work from the, excuse me, from my income sources is, I'm still working to try and get my income back to the level it was, with client services, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
it's not all sexy.
The other thing that I had on my mind, cause it's something I can relate to, is, even though you're your own boss with all of these, you still have these self-set deadlines to get the podcast out on time, to do regular updates on your theme, to get a course done by a certain date. And actually that one, you may have a contractual obligation if you're doing the course for somebody else. Is that something that you enjoy, or is that easier than client deadlines? What's it been like for you?
I've learned about myself that I'm a wonderful procrastinator. So I need deadlines. Deadlines help me kind of have, an actual date to shoot toward and push toward. So I find deadlines very helpful.
Have you read the Wait But Why procrastination series?
I haven't.
Oh.
I was waiting to read it.
Oh, you are in for, I mean, you and, you're just going to be amazed. You'll learn about a couple of characters, and it all starts to make sense, but there's the monkey and the monster. I know, it's awesome. They have plush toys for sale. Like, it's that life changing that I want the plush toy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I've added it to my. I've written that down on a sticky note, and I'm going to go get it. I'm reading another book of yours. Or recommendation of yours right now, the Post Office one.
Oh, yeah?
So I'll cue this one next.
Nice. Yeah, so it's the Instant Gratification Monkey and the Panic Monster. And it'll make sense once you read the three blog posts. But, like, my wife, who is not a procrastinator, very type A, like, she was in tears laughing at how much this described my life and our 13-year relationship or whatever it's been. And one of the results for the author was that he found greater peace with kind of short-term deadlines, like writing a blog post or something, you know, like something regular, like writing a podcast or doing a podcast every week. And you would think that would be antithetical for a procrastinator, but it's actually not, because procrastinators, where we really fail is when you say, like, here's your term paper. It's the only thing you're going to be graded on, and you have all semester to do it. That's where a procrastinator really, really fails, because they don't do anything until like the last week. It's like, yep. Great. I have a whole term to do nothing. And then I'm going to die in the last week trying to make this thing quasi work.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. So I've similarly found greater peace with kind of shorter deadlines. And it's why I write a newsletter for a living.
Nice.
Anyway, so let's dig into these a little more. How did you get enough traction on something like your podcast, for instance, to where you felt comfortable charging for it? And how did you showcase value to sponsors to give you money for that?
Sure. So the podcast was around for quite a while before I ever approached anyone about sponsorship. And, you know, what you noticed and commented on, the consistency of the show is one thing that I think is attractive to sponsors, because it's not a, you know, not a fly by night sort of thing. And then also just over time, the audience I've built, perhaps unfortunately, people actually listen to what I say and sometimes buy things because of something I said, which is really frightening. I had a lady one time email and say she bought something I suggested and she didn't like it. It wasn't the right product for her. But she goes, I buy everything you tell me to buy. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that is the most frightening thing I have ever heard. Please, please do not buy everything I suggest, if it's not right for you. But anyhow, so knowing that I have an audience that, thankfully values, what I have to say on certain things and, a very loyal and committed audience at that. It's not a huge audience, but the audiences that I do have is in a very specific niche. And they're very loyal listeners. So I think that is the value proposition that I brought to sponsors. And I'm not going to lie, Krogsgaard, if I were to get advertising based on typical cost per click or cost per download or whatever the metric is for a podcast, I would make like 21 cents an episode.
Yeah, it would not typically be... I think the real world, not the WordPress world, but the real world, I think kind of manages it based on downloads or listens, which a listen is typically really just a download. It's based on like however many thousands of listens per episode or downloads per episode can demand X dollars. For more generic podcasts, it changes when you get into niches.
Yeah, I think truly the sponsorships that I've gotten are people who are businesses that are supporting the community, and not like they're just throwing money for the sake of throwing money. But I think the fact that it's a supportive community that wants to, wants to help see the show succeed, that they financially support it, even though it may not be the ROI might not be there.
Yeah. That's something that I deal with as well, for sure, because I think I agree. I think the way a lot of people look at this, and I've talked to other content creators in our space, as much as we want as content creators and to create as much value as we can for a partner, they are probably going to look at it similar to how they look at either WordCamp sponsorships or general event sponsorships as kind of a community contribution to be doing good within the community or supporting good content within the community. And that does definitely make it different. So if someone's listening to this and they're looking to do something similar, it probably depends on what kind of community you're in terms of what you can demand for a podcast. Because I don't know if you want to get into actual rates that are charged versus actual listens and stuff, but it's a very interesting conversation that I've had privately with several other podcasters. And yes, in my opinion, generally the sponsorship dollars are incredibly expensive, per listen or per download for most podcast sponsors. Therefore, for anyone listening to this, when you do hear a sponsor on a WordPress-specific podcast, tell them thanks, because they're not doing it because they're getting tons of, ROI necessarily. You can get some good ROI on some. I've heard some good stories about some podcasters or podcasts, maybe not specifically in the WordPress space, but in the web space, where a sponsor got a lot of new customers or new attention because of a sponsorship spot. But it's a tough one. Anyway, so.
Yeah, it's not a source of income that I plan on having indefinitely. I think there will be a point when the well runs dry, so to speak.
Interesting.
That sounds so downer-ish. I don't mean it that way, but, you know.
Well, maybe you'll transition it into a broader partnership that doesn't just include the podcast or something.
Yeah, I've thought down that angle too, although I haven't fully pursued it yet. But yes, partnerships that extend beyond just the podcast.
For anyone that doesn't know, that's what my setup is. I don't sell. Mine's multifaceted for why I do it the way that I do. One is I don't want to have to be worrying about advertisement and sponsorship and partner stuff week in and week out. So I actually sell 12 partner slots on a yearly basis, and then they sponsor everything that PostStatus does, whether it's blog posts, newsletters, the podcast, and I just rotate them through. And that's worked well for me. And it's allowed me to just kind of, when I lump it all together, try to say, like, here's the value that I've provided. And yeah, so we'll find out. My renewals are like right now for partners. So I should find out how many people renew. And, it's a funny thing. The WordPress world is a funny space, but you know, I guess the lesson here for an individual versus me and Carrie just navel gazing, might be that if you are creating content and looking to get some kind of sponsorship for it, no matter your community or your niche, like just talk to people and see what they might be willing to do and tell them what your goals are, and you can probably work something out. And then if you stay consistent, then it's even more attractive. Consistency across the board for this kind of stuff is, I think, important to most sponsors.
Absolutely. And it really goes back to relationship. So, you know, getting out, meeting people, especially at WordCamps and that sort of thing. But that's where you're going to meet the people that would sponsor, at least if you're looking at a WordPress-based podcast.
Yeah. Are most of your sponsors people that you know personally? Or?
Yes. I'm going through in my my mental Rolodex. There's been a handful of times where someone has contacted me out of the blue looking to sponsor the show. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. I'm shocked.
Yeah.
For the most part, I'll throw a percentage of 90% out there are people that I have a personal relationship with.
Gotcha. So let's dig into another thing where I really have no experience, and I know you do this more. I don't understand exactly how it works for different people and how effective it is for different traffic sources either. But affiliate marketing is something that's very common for monetizing a blog, and obviously there's a lot of people have different opinions on it. The reason I personally don't do it on my main blog is because a lot of people view PostStatus as like a news organization. And so to me, affiliate links didn't feel right for the main, like primary content, you know, like the main blog feed.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I'm totally opposed, because I think it could be appropriate for other parts of PostStatus, that are not like the newsish part. But I don't put any affiliate links in either my blog posts or like the notes that I send to members and stuff. But I have absolutely no qualms with it for people that are providing resource style material or tutorials or guides or anything like that. I think it's a smart way to monetize a blog. So what's your process been like in regards to doing affiliate stuff and managing it and finding the right fit and all that kind of thing?
Oh, well, I'll start by saying this. It is not a get-rich-quick scheme. I've had, you know, a lot of people approach me about asking about affiliate marketing and, you know, wanting to turn their blog into a cash machine. And that's just not happening. Or maybe it could for some people. That's not my experience. But I think it 5 years ago, I don't think I even knew what affiliate marketing was. But when I started working a lot with Studio Press and the Genesis framework, I was simultaneously writing a lot of tutorial style content about those products. And I've learned about their affiliate program, signed up, and just started using their links. And that was my first experience as an affiliate. And the intention there was not to, it was basically, hey, can I make a few extra dollars each month? There was no empire building or anything like that. And that's actually still how I view affiliate income. It's it can be a significant source of income. I mean, it's not non-trivial. I guess I could just say it's not trivial. Wait, oh, man, I'm getting my double negatives messed up.
It's not trivial income.
It's not trivial income, but I don't want to treat it as a given because, you know, you never know. But I do see a direct correlation between the frequency of me posting and affiliate revenue because, I mean, it's just a numbers game, right? So percentage of people that are on the site, you know, over time, that's going to average out to a certain dollar amount. And
right. So you might have 1,000 readers and one person buy something based on what you put in there and you make $50 off of it.
Exactly.
Or for some stuff more. And different products carry different affiliate rates, right?
Yes. So depending on like some web hosts have really generous,
I've seen as high as $150 or $200 for WP Engine and stuff. I actually talked to Jason Cohen. If listeners might have heard me if they got far enough into the interview where I was talking about how, like, you know, and y'all are paying out $150, $200 for affiliate fees. That's expensive to acquire a customer. And he was like, no, that's not expensive. He was acting like it was cheap because comparing it to the other efforts that you might have to make to acquire that customer. So it was really interesting to get the host's perspective on that because when you consider lifetime value for what they get out of the average WP Engine customer, it's not as expensive. I'm sure it would be for non-managed hosts, like somebody that's only getting $4 or $5 a month out of the affiliate revenue. The person would have to, it's like giving up the first year of income even for $50.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was interesting to hear about that. But I also know, like, if you do like an Amazon affiliate link, you get like 4% of the sale. And it's not necessarily like what's funny about Amazon is if you do an Amazon link, they might not buy what you linked them to, but then they go buy something else and you get the affiliate revenue from whatever's on the cookie. So yes. Like, you could link some. I did this. I think I have a dongle blog that's a joke, but I put an affiliate link for a dongle on there, and then I think somebody bought an espresso machine or something like that.
Nice.
So I think I got like, I don't know, $8, something like that. I thought it was funny. Is that the same way it works for most of the affiliate programs that you link to? Like, people could buy things that aren't what you explicitly link to.
Amazon is the only one that works like that. Let's say it's a Studio Press theme and I link to a specific theme and they don't buy that theme, but they buy another because it's...
Then that would apply too.
Then that would apply. But I've done some experimenting. I have a couple of posts that are by far in a way exceed the rest of my posts in terms of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really kind of random, but I have tried running different types of affiliate links on those to see what converts. And I'm telling you, I'm not very successful at it. But you know, if you go into Google Analytics, you can see what the demographic is and what they call I can't remember exactly how they phrase it, but it tells you if they're technophiles or Shutterbugs or all that kind of stuff.
So it like profiles the person that clicked?
Yes. So I went through and I was like, okay, so 70% of the people who land on this, you know, analytics is deeming them some sort of a photography person. So I'm like, okay, I can work with that. So I went to Amazon and got a link for a tripod. It's actually the tripod that my husband uses. And threw that on the post. Crickets. That thing didn't get a single click. What else have I tried? So now I'm trying native shopping ads, which supposedly would be more traditional advertising, cookie-based advertising, so that whatever is relevant to that individual is what's going to show up in the ad. And so far, that has not netted a single sale either, even though that one's only been active, I think, 2 weeks or so. But I don't spend a lot of time dorking with it because there's better uses of my time. But there are those top posts I do tend to play with and see what works and mostly what doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything or have you ever experimented with recurring affiliate revenue? I think it's ConvertKit is one that's top of mind to me, where you actually get a referral fee plus you get a percentage of the referrals payment to whatever the service is, as long as they're a customer. So some of those can be incredibly profitable, I guess, because if someone's a customer of something for 2 years, you get like a small portion of their monthly fee for that whole 2 years. So have you done any of those where you're an affiliate for something that's recurring?
I have not.
Are you about to switch to ConvertKit?
You know what? Funny enough, I actually am a ConvertKit affiliate, although I don't think I've ever made a sale through them. I was on MailChimp, then I moved to ConvertKit, and then they kind of pissed me off, so I moved over to ActiveCampaign. And now I think Paul Jarvis has got me talked into going back to MailChimp, so of which there is no affiliate program.
There is an affiliate program. It's just, I think you get like $8 or something. I don't know.
Okay.
And I think the only real way they show it is to click the monkey in the bottom of the newsletter or something. I don't know.
Is it the panic monkey?
No, it's different monkey. This is our second monkey reference of the day. For reference though, if anyone's interested, Paul Jarvis, has a course called Chimp Essentials, where he talks about really going the next level with email marketing, and specifically with MailChimp through automation and like drip campaigns and all sorts of stuff that you might not necessarily think that you can do in MailChimp. I've taken that course. It's very good. I've not implemented it well, but it's one of my goals for 2017. It was one of my goals for 2016. But it's one of my goals for 2017 to do better at implementing some of what Paul does. And in general, I think that's a good segue. I want to talk about email and how you can leverage email and your list. I see you have a nice call to action for your list. So we'll get into that in a minute. But first, speaking of sponsors from earlier, let's pay some post status bills. And our partner of the week is actually ProsPress. And some of you may know what ProsPress is, but what you really definitely know is what their product is, which is the most popular WooCommerce extension on the market, WooCommerce subscriptions. So ProsPress makes WooCommerce subscriptions. It's it can power what's a very, very, very popular concept in e-commerce these days, like send someone a monthly box. So like if Carrie wants to, on a monthly basis, send people her newest t-shirt design, she could have a t-shirt subscription service, and every month you would get a new t-shirt designed to carry standards, and you would be able to manage that through subscriptions. So it can do it for physical products. It's the same type of thing, like what are they, like Harry's razors or those types of things are. Super, super popular for that. What I use it for is for managing all the subscriptions on PostStatus. So it's a yearly subscription product on PostStatus, and it works great. It's extremely powerful. You can do free trials. You can do all sorts of stuff. They've got customers that use it in all sorts of crazy and interesting ways. I recently saw one. My friend Daniel Espinoza worked on a project where they're using WooCommerce subscriptions by ProsPress to do coffee deliveries, counterculture coffee, and it's a great implementation. So yeah, check out WooCommerce subscriptions. If you're a PostStatus member, you can get a deal at poststatus.com/deals. All members have access to that. And go to prospress.com to learn more about their team. They also have a couple other nice plugins, but WooCommerce subscriptions is their bread and butter, and it's wonderful, works great. Check them out. Thank you to ProsPress for being a PostStatus partner. Carrie.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about email. Let's talk about email.
All right, let's do it.
Is your email list something that you're utilizing heavily right now or not?
No. I have two lists. One is for carriedills.com, and then the other one is for my podcast. Mm-hmm. And the podcast one is very active because the podcast is active. The other one is not so active because I can't seem to get around to writing a regular post for my for my blog. Therefore, I don't want to bug people too often. Hmm. I forgot what the original question. Oh, am I leveraging it?
Are you leveraging it?
Probably not to the best extent that I could be. I'm actually just signed up to take that Chimp Essentials course because I think that I could. By using some segmentation and a little bit of automation that I could probably tailor content better to the individual subscriber. I think I could do a lot more there. It's just like you, it's been on my to-do list for a while to set up some email automations and I just don't seem to get there.
Yeah. It's, I think it's something that a lot of people that are creating regular content from a blog perspective are not taking advantage of properly, which is a shame, especially because you probably have a lot of content that's not necessarily brand new, but that would be, you could pretty easily format in a way that would be an introduction for new subscribers. I think at a very minimum, a good thing to do for people in our shoes where we're trying to make money and figure out a way to encourage people to give us money and show our value that we provide to them in one way or the other. One of the things that we could easily do is set up kind of a welcome campaign for a new subscriber mm-hmm. so that they get like a 3 to 4 email series. And that's pretty straightforward to do in most email applications. I've been doing a lot of research into the e-commerce space, like the physical goods e-commerce space. And it's a really big deal in that space. To kind of do those welcome sequences for people or things like that. But I have to say, you're probably missing out on some easy revenue there, Carrie.
I know. You know what I really want? I want someone to come in, audit my content, and then just set it all up for me.
Tell you the parts where your content is valuable in an evergreen manner and do it for you, huh? That's a good That's a good service that someone could provide. So,
yeah, I would pay for that.
But nobody knows your bank of content as well as you do.
Yeah, that's why ultimately it does need to be me that does it. But
yeah, that's something I run into this frequently where there's a conversation going on in PostStatus Slack or something like that, and you know I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh yeah, I wrote a blog post about that in 2011. Here it is. It's like, y'all don't remember this? 5 years ago. And you know, something could still be relevant, but it's, you have to be the one to bring that back up to people. And you know, marketing yourself is a challenge, I think, but it is effective. And if you're providing a solution for somebody, giving them something helpful, then they're not going to be opposed to that, I don't think.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, I have Paul on. Let's see how much we can talk about Paul Jarvis. But
That's fine by me. I really like him. So.
He's awesome. I had him on my podcast a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about email automation. And one thing he said that's kind of stuck with me is, you don't have to create this huge, massive web of automations out the gate. Like, it can start with one thing, mm-hmm. like your welcome email. And then, you know, just and you kind of brick by brick build more complex automations. But I was like, okay, that's doable. I can start there.
Yeah. And there's somebody else in the e-commerce space, Drew something or another. He runs a website called Nerd Marketing. And I listen to his podcast, and he talks about email all the time. And he's frequently said something that I've thought over and over again, like, duh, this is absolutely right. I'm an idiot. But, you know, you pay for your marketing, you pay for your email list based on size, no matter what. So if you're not emailing them, you get unlimited numbers of emails that you can actually send to them. But if you're not emailing them, if you're not doing things like filtering out people that are never going to convert, you know, like if they never open your email or whatever, based on these campaigns that you send, you're not removing them automatically. You're not kind of feeding the list and sending emails to send people to your website or to a product you want them to buy or whatever. You're literally just spending money on that email list for absolutely no reason. It's like, it really puts it in perspective. Not only are you not making additional money,
you're spending
through people that are voluntarily giving you their email address. You're spending money to then not send them anything when they asked you to send them something because they volunteered their email address to you. So that has sufficiently made me feel stupid. when I really bring that to light to myself.
Now I can feel stupid with you.
Yeah. Welcome to the club. I've been giving you a little bit of a hard time about that. I email my paid membership list pretty regularly, but I am horrible, horrible at emailing my free list. So that is a thing that is actually going to have to change very, very soon for me, because it's a requirement for me to market better to that list when I do the job board. Because why would someone put a job on the job board if I'm not doing the very simple thing of sending those jobs out to my free list of potential job seekers? So, yeah, I got to get myself together on that. And then additionally, these automation sequences, I mean, you can set it up in a day and that gets people introed to whatever you want them to be introed to. So if other people out there are trying to make money, trying to make it on their own, then definitely be thinking about your email list from the beginning. Don't be like me and Carrie. We are clearly missing some opportunities. Do you have any favorite email newsletters that are kind of along these lines of like somebody that had a really good welcome sequence or somebody that just is consistently putting something out there that you really enjoy? And Postatus would obviously be your first answer, so you can't say that.
Well, naturally, Postatus. And then I'll bring up Paul once again. He has
Sunday Dispatches.
Yeah, Sunday Dispatches. And even for his Chimp Essentials course, he's got some great onboarding there. And you know, like if you click something, that's going to trigger some automation. And if you don't click, what am I not going to get? Yeah, so it's Paul's emails are fun. Amy Lynn Andrews is a newsletter that I love getting every week. It's just, and she's affiliate-based. I assume that's where she's making most of her money on that through affiliate links in her emails. But it's just digest-style awesomeness, just kind of around the web. It's not for a very technical audience, but it's interesting little tips and tidbits. Onboarding sequence. I'm trying to remember. ConvertKit actually had a nice, which you would expect them to, a really nice onboarding process. So you got, you know, you set up paid, set up your account, whatever. And then the drip campaign that came from that was like, hey, all right, let's set up your list. Let's go through this together. Let's set up you're this and that. And so kind of walk you through the process of getting up and running.
Okay. So those will be in the show notes for anybody that's interested. Let's stick on the tools front for a second then. Are there any other tools that you've found to be significantly helpful for your business? you have a toolbox on your website.
I do. Of which quite a few of those links are affiliate links. But I will say this, I'll throw the disclaimer out there, that I feel very strongly about not recommending crappy stuff. Mm-hmm. So if I'm recommending it, it's because I feel good about it. So, and it also does not dictate the content that I write. Mm-hmm. Anyways, just felt like I needed to.
We don't have to go through all of these, but if you had to throw out one or two things that you've particularly found useful, what would you say?
So something I use every single day is Todoist, which is, and I don't even know if that's on the list. It's a to-do list app.
I was about to say, this better be a to-do list app.
Yeah. That's great for, have you ever read, Getting Things Done? I'm kind of blanking on, I think it's Michael Gerber.
I don't think I have.
It's a really great read, but, and so you might hear it referred to as like the GTD method, but one of the things he talks about is, you know, there's always thoughts entering your head, like ideas or things that you need to do, or, you know, did I, you know, get this? Have I done this? Da 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 da. And mm-hmm. it's hard to keep a single train of thought, you know, with all these other little things popping in your head. So his part of the Getting Things Done method is to empty out those things of your head so that you don't have to waste brain space remembering what it is. So and Todoist is actually born out of kind of that Getting Things Done method. But anyway, so you're let's say I'm editing my podcast and all of a sudden I remember that I need to cut somebody a check. Well, I can pop over to Todoist and make that a to-do item and then hop right back into where I was versus trying to remember, like in the back of my head, okay, don't forget to write the check. Don't forget to write the check. Anyway, maybe other people have normal brains and can manage a checklist
style to-do list app so that you can get the satisfaction of crossing them off and all that?
You sure can. And it even has like a strike through line. it's pretty cool. Yeah. So that would probably be my number one.
That's where your mental space is every day of getting things on that list and knocking them off. Your self-accountability, I guess.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind using Asana or something like that, but they don't have a desktop app and that bugs me. Mm. I don't want to have to be logged into a website to manage that stuff.
Yeah. I've never managed to stick with a to-do list app per se. I use SimpleNote for my brain space. I just make a new thing in SimpleNote. Make my notes there. I've not used it as much recently for actual to-do items. I've moved to good old pen and paper for most of those because I also like scratching it off when I'm done. feels good to do that, but it's great for regular stuff, taking notes, things like that. Plus one on to-do lists. It's very helpful for disciplining yourself as a self-employed person.
Indeed. Oh, I got one more.
Yeah.
And I don't ever even think about this because it's just sort of in the background, but 1Password.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So it's beautiful. So just
I have
one little
love affair with 1Password.
Oh, my gosh. It's fantastic. I see other people's passwords now. They'll, you know, I'll ask them for credentials, site credentials or something, and they'll send them to me. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I could hack every bank account. I know you use this single password for everything under the sun, and it's terribly weak.
Especially because it's you know, the password that they give you is something so specific to them, like it's their wife's name with like a number one at the end, an exclamation point or something, and it's like, oh no. Like this is just everywhere. It's like
that makes it secure if you add that exclamation point at the end.
Yeah. I was recently at a family member's house and I was trying to send them some pictures they couldn't get through based on the Dropbox link that I'd sent them. So I was logging into my Dropbox on their computer. And I couldn't copy and paste or anything because whatever. So I was with the 1Password app on my phone. I was typing my automatically generated Dropbox password, and it was just blowing their mind. They were looking at me type this like 50 or 60 character password into their computer. And then I was like, oh, hold on, I'm not done, because now I've got 2-factor authentication that I got to do. And they were just like, what? And I agree, if you're like randomly putting your account information into some unknown device, that can be a challenge to do it that way. But the 1Password application is also a browser extension, a Mac app, and it's on your phone. It's super easy to manage for all your own devices. So yeah, it's a lifesaver. I don't get scared when people say something got hacked anymore, because I just go and I change that one thing and I'm done. Because yep. I don't even know what any of my passwords are. I just manage them out of 1Password. It's great. So big plus one on that one. And if people don't have a Mac, because I've heard the 1Password app is not great for Windows. LastPass is another good solution in terms of doing the same thing, just not necessarily as gloriously as 1Password does.
I actually used it for a while, and I don't remember it. Something about it irritated me, so I switched. But yeah,
A proud moment for me was converting my account to a family account so that my wife now uses it as well.
Nice.
That was a big deal in my household.
Yeah. My husband uses it too, but I don't know his master password, so I'm still screwed.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we made sure my wife knows my master password so that, you know, if I kick the bucket, she can log in and get all the money out. do all the business stuff. Okay. Well, this has been fun so far. What should we finish up with? We'll have the guest's choice of a topic. It can be anything.
Oh man.
I put you on the spot.
You did put me on the spot. I was like, does it have to be WordPress related? Is it?
No, it can be absolutely anything. This is, let's say, to be about business, making money, doing something on your own, or tools. This has kind of been the route we've gone with this podcast.
Okay, well, let's talk Uber.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about your, what would we call this?
The Uber experiment of 2017.
Yeah, maybe the hidden costs of doing business.
Yes.
So this blog post you wrote, you were an Uber driver for a day, or roughly a day. You did 3 rides. So yeah. Tell us a little bit about what your takeaways from that were.
So the, There's so much that I learned in that very short period of time, one of which was don't speed to get your person to a destination because you're paid by the minute. there would be one. But I started kind of doing the math in my head and then later on put it down in pen and paper. But, you know, what it was actually costing me to offer, you know, to make this money. And in my brief experiment, I actually lost money. I came out like negative $20 or something. Now, I'm sure if I were to do it again, I would know some things and make some different decisions. And I'm sure it averages out that indeed it's profitable or people wouldn't do it. But it was sort of interesting to think about, you know, when you think about income, whatever the source of income is, that income's great, income's good, all income is wonderful. But when you factor in what it costs you to earn that income, it's income is not always good.
Both in time and in actual potential costs of whatever material or tools that are required or whatever.
Exactly.
In your Uber example, you used the whatever it is, the governmental standard for mileage costs of a car. So it's like the average cost of a mile for cars. It's what's used for reimbursing people for corporate mileage and stuff. And just based on that, without surge pricing, So you were just getting 1x of whatever the standard fare was, mm-hmm. plus the fact that you might have to go two ways but only have a fare one way for your longest trip, you discovered that your hourly rate ended up basically negative for those three rides, because for one of them in particular, you didn't have a ride back. So, but even if you assume you had a ride back for that one, like, you could work it out to where, because of the cost of your car and mileage and all the things that you have to do, plus the amount of time that you spend, you're really not making very much money as a rideshare driver, even though your revenue might have been, you know, so many dollars per day. I think that's actually a really smart thing to consider no matter what line of business you're getting into. I see this really, really often. When I see entrepreneurs or self-employed folks talk about what they're going to get into, because they're, especially with regards to the amount of time that we spend on something, mm-hmm. We really need to be cognizant of what kind of time doing something is going to cost us. I'll give an example. So let's say you're working on something, or you have a product, and you really have this itch to redesign your own website, redesign and rebuild. And you might spend weeks doing that. And in the meantime, you might have been able to make a lot more effective, you might have been able to get a lot more effective results out of spending that time on your actual copy instead of the redesign and redevelopment. But if you choose to put those resources into the wrong bucket, then you might be costing yourself something. You got to see what you're going to get out of that. And I would say on average, like, if you're going to rebuild, redesign your website, unless it's truly atrocious ahead of time, you're probably just probably just scratching your own itch, not really doing what your customers want you to do. With PostStatus, I've really had to fight this, because there are times where I just want to, like, throw the whole website away, redo it all. And then I realize, number one, my actual customers don't go to my website that much because I email things to them. And number two, the website is fine. You know,
like, I love the PostStatus site.
Oh, well, thank you. But, it's fine. I'm not like, it's not, there's nothing really bad about it, and anything that's terrible about it in my own mind is so minimal in terms of what I would gain by completely redoing it and rethinking it. And if I put that same amount of time towards other stuff, like better setting up landing pages or, you know, things like that, better
setting up your email automation,
those are potentially much more valuable things. And that's what I got from your Uber post, because Carrie, you know, I hate to break it to you, but you probably have better talents and ways to spend your time than driving a car. And even though, you know, you might say, well, I probably wouldn't have made $50 in those 3 hours at home, but your brain space can be used in a different way than driving a car. And in my opinion, I think you're probably better off not being an Uber driver and spending your time and your energy and your brain space where it's going to be more valuable.
This is true.
Mm-hmm. That's what I got out of your Uber post, but I think everybody should read it. It's fascinating. Yeah. It just makes me sad when I see people spending time in the wrong place. Well, this isn't to say you, but I do see a lot of other people doing this, and myself.
Well, that, and one of the things that sparked the post was hearing from several friends that are employed, and this is outside the WordPress space, so whatever, but how they're doing salary cuts, they're doing labor cuts, all because of mismanagement of funds over an extended period of time. And it's not like it's not like anybody was embezzling or, you know, anything bad. It's just that people in the position of power of how money you've spent didn't make good decisions about financial decisions, good business decisions. And so the result is, even though a company is extremely profitable and there's tons of business coming in, they can't pay people what they're worth. I'm just like, that's, how does somebody get to be on top of a company and not freaking know how to run run the financials? Anyways,
we're all faking it, and that has real consequences as a company grows, I think, is one of the ways to look at that. Not all faking it, but we're all like just trying to solve the problems that are in front of us. And I think if you're not planning as you become a big company, if you're not intentional to manage certain things, then they're going to manage themselves, and they may manage themselves very poorly.
Indeed.
So, you know, there's something that we didn't talk about one iota, and it's the fact that you're writing a book. So why don't we end the show by you plugging your book?
Sweet. I love every opportunity to promote myself. So thank you, Brian.
What's the domain where people need to go to for this book, and what's the book about?
The domain is realworldfreelancing.com, and that's actually the title of the book as well. So this is something I'm co-writing with Diane Kinney, who has her own agency. And it's our combined experience over many years of offering services as a freelancer. And basically what we, if I could sit down my, early 20s self and say, here's your handbook, that's what I envision it being.
Well, Diane was also on the podcast, to talk. We talked much more about like service type of stuff. So if you combine these two discussions, you kind of get the self-employment non-service stuff and you get the service stuff. So that's another good episode to listen to. And their book is going to be great. Both Carrie and Diane are always helpful in the post-status Slack chatting with other folks. So go to realworldfreelancing.com, carriedills.com, officehours.fm. And of course, poststatus.com/club to join the Poststatus Club and the other 900-ish folks that are there. Carrie, thanks so much for joining me for this podcast, and we'll catch everybody next time.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Bye.